Sam Mayfield, question and answer following a viewing of her documentary film, Wisconsin Rising.
You have to tell us, so what happened afterwards? Did they ever get collective bargaining?
No, they did not ever get collective bargaining back. In short, they did not ever get collective bargaining back. It's a very long process to actually, for them to have ever gained the right to collectively bargain in the first place. So there's all of that work to be done. And there's talk of trying to backpedal on the law that was passed, Act 10, but it's there. I mean, they don't have the right to collectively bargain, and as a result of that, a lot of the unions, the union membership all throughout Wisconsin is incredibly low.
Oh, so therefore, if there's no collective bargaining, that means that the state doesn't sit down with the clerks or the corrections officers or the
janitors or the street plow drivers or the teachers or anyone, right?
They just don't sit down.
Right.
So it's they can dictate the terms and condition of employment on their own that the state can.
Yeah.
That's a curious situation. I would almost think that
it's not fair. Really. I mean, there are other states that don't have collective bargaining as well. I mean, it's not. Yes, I mean, it seems like, from a worker's standpoint, it should be illegal, right? To not be able to get together with your fellow workers and say, this is an unsafe working condition. Yeah, unbelievable.
Or we want to have some control over conditions of employment.
Yeah, incredible.
Could you talk a little bit about how the recall over the activists at the state capitol?
Well, there was a lot of... there was always, from early on, there was talk of a general strike. And from early on, there was talk of a recall. And I remember going back home to Vermont and saying to my friends there, okay, well, I'm going to Wisconsin. We'll see. I think I might be going to a state where they're about to have a general strike. Because it really wasn't totally clear if the recall process was going to be where the movement put all of its energy. It did seem to be possible that a general strike was going to happen. And ultimately, I mean, according to many people in Wisconsin who were involved in the movement, the Democrats co-opted the movement and the energy that was existing there and diverted it into the recall process. And there's huge tension in the state now still as a result of that. I mean, really a divided state. The first time that I showed this film in Wisconsin, a fight broke out in the audience. It was an audience of about 300 people in the Barrymore Theater, and a fight broke out. And a fist fight, but it was a screaming match. And it was a person who believed that the energy should have been kept with the grassroots and in the general strike, and someone who believed that there wasn't enough energy put into the recall process, that people could have done more. Really divided.
Was that just the state Democratic Party or the state Democratic Party and the Democratic Party?
Yes. The state Democratic Party and the National Democratic Party. I mean, the state Democratic Party in Wisconsin, as evidenced by the two different candidates who've now run against Scott Walker, Tom Barrett, who ran against him in the recall, who he lost to the first time that he ran against Tom Barrett. So this person that Walker ran against in the 2012 recall election lost to Walker in 2010. So they didn't like him the first time around. And then the Democrats re-ran him. They didn't even change his suit. They re-ran the guy. And he didn't run, didn't do anything different, as far as I could tell from the outside. And when, you know, so Walker, I've been covering elections and I've been covering elections since 2001. This was the fastest calling of any election that I've ever seen. I mean, the polls open and the polls closed. When the polls closed at 7 p.m., I mean, it was called so quickly. You know, Walker declared victory. Tom Barrett conceded. Tom Barrett walks off stage, and the first thing that happens to him is he gets slapped in the face by one of his constituents because she couldn't believe that he conceded. And she couldn't believe that this was the kind of campaign that he ran. So, as evidenced by this person that the Democratic Party chose, and then later Mary Burke, who many people said was not a particularly strong candidate either, she, though, had what I think the Democrats thought was going to be the piece that really would win them the election, and that was a lot of money. She comes from the family of Trek bicycles. You know, did you ever hear of these bicycles, Trek? So she has a lot of money, and I think her politics are aligned, of course, with the Democratic Party, but she wasn't a particularly strong candidate either. So this is all to say that the Democratic Party of Wisconsin is particularly confused. Or, I mean, I don't know if they're more confused than other Democratic parties around the country, but...
Is Wisconsin a variable state? Is it blue or red or maybe...
It's a totally variable state. It's a schizophrenic state. I mean, it brought Bob La Falla, the first progressive, and also McCarthy. Yeah. And this is the way that it's, you know, it's not like it always goes blue or that it always goes red. It's a total wild card. But now, I mean, you know, I mean, it is red right now, with as evidenced by the numbers with the election. So it's an interesting time. The Republican Party did a really masterful job of bringing out people in rural Wisconsin who weren't voting before, conservative folks.
When did you notice the national press kind of zeroing in on Wisconsin? Thousands of people protested and nothing in the national news, and then all of a sudden, a massive amount of people. What do you think was the...
Are you asking what do I think the catalyst was for the national news to finally pick up on it?
Yeah. You didn't say anything.
No, I mean, I can't say. I'm not sure. I mean, there were celebrities that came to town.
Yeah, I know as a person.
Ed Schultz picked it up. I mean, Ed Schultz had a particular interest in the story, and so MSNBC was kind of following it.
Yeah.
But, you know, they kind of picked it up and they dropped it many times, but indeed. I mean, in the summer, there were Ed Schultz came to Wisconsin during the Senate recalls in early August before the
gubernatorial.
Before the gubernatorials, but there were a couple of different Senate recalls that summer, 2011, and Ed Schultz came. And the capital of Wisconsin is, the city of Madison is kind of built around the capital. So there's this huge capital building, and then there's a huge circle that goes around the capital, and driving circle. And Ed Schultz and the crew had taken over one of the blocks and one of the corners. And it was massive. I mean, thousands and thousands of people in the streets for this huge national television program. So they picked it up but dropped it. Yeah. Yeah, which is like the major failing of our media. You know, I mean, there isn't an example of the mainstream media picking up a story that's actually changing the way that politics are happening.
You mentioned the follow-up. You have the follow-up. That regularly has 10,000 people attend. Nobody covers.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. Yeah, and there are...
You get 10 Tea Party people together and there's helicopters.
Yeah.
Pretty big.
Yeah. Helicopters for 10 people, it's true. It's wild.
Can you comment on the palm trees fiasco?
What do you want me to say about the palm trees?
Well, maybe what you saw there, because you've photographed folks with blow up palm trees, and people wearing palm tree lampshades.
Yeah.
And but I mean, well,
they were coming from out of state.
Right. They're out of state plastic, Chinese actually made. blow up palm trees.
But the palm tree thing was, I mean, it was just so beautiful because the one thing, you know, this movement, and I think all movements ultimately, you know, there are artists, luckily, thankfully, that come out and they do the thing that they do so well, which is to make it colorful and vibrant and engaging and animated. And so many people showed up all the time. There were, I mean, I have so much palm tree footage of people doing these creative animated things with palm trees. And I mean, it was just such a great, it was, you know, a gentle and comical response to this thing that's really unbelievable. You know, it's unbelievable that they would, you know, that they would do this coverage and they would lie. But I mean, it's consistent with what they do, so we shouldn't be surprised. But at the same time, it informs people that are watching and not digging any deeper than the media they're seeing. And as far as the out-of-town people, I mean, it's incredible that this was a piece that was used against so many folks in the movement. But the truth is that there were a lot of people from out of town. It certainly was not the majority, but there were a lot of people, and I think that that's a testimony to how important the movement was, because people cared. You know, people cared so much that they came and they wanted to get in with their whole body. I've shown the film at so many places around the country, and so many people have come up to me and said, I mean, so many stories that are the same, and the story is, I was watching this at home with my spouse, and I turned to my spouse and I said, I have to go to Wisconsin. And then, you know, they figured out with their family and how to take care of their kids and how to take off time from work. And they got in their car and they drove across the country, or they drove for 10 hours or something like that, because they were so inspired by what they saw, you know, and also outraged by the injustices. But I mean, really, a lot of people, you guys. So many, you know, in these random places, little tiny towns, Oneonta, New York, all over the place, people have that story of just packing it up and driving. And it was cold and it was icy, but they still did it. And then when I got there, you know, I mean, I got there and then I met a lot of these people who, you know, the guy at the end with the cheeseburger or the turkey sandwiches, hey, you with the camera, you want a turkey sandwich? At the end of the credits, he said that. And that man had been giving away hundreds and hundreds of turkey sandwiches. That's what he did. He was from California. And the reason he drove was because his dad had passed away the year before. And his dad was a union man his whole life and was a hardworking person. And I think that person was probably, you know, he had probably been very depressed or sad. And this gave him hope and inspiration. And so he drove from California and made turkey sandwiches at the Wisconsin State Capitol for weeks. So.
You're from Vermont, so you know how cold it gets in the wintertime. At least it does. I can say, being from northeastern Ohio, that Madison also gets very cold.
Oh, so cold. Yeah.
I mean, that is part of the snow belt. And they get snowed in all the time.
Yeah.
It's amazing to see all the people that were out there.
Even though it's 20 degrees.
Yeah. February 27th, I think, was one of the dates on there.
Yeah.
And they're all out there, you know, the end of February, that's still cold.
And then people are walking around the Capitol all the time, and that's fine, but you're walking, so you can kind of keep warm. But at these demonstrations where, like, Michael Moore was there, or when the senators came back, you know, these were demonstrations that lasted all day. And you're not doing anything but standing still, you know,
right.
Standing still and, like, occasionally chanting. But, so.
Yeah, just a sort of a side note. A Fox News outlet tried to defame some of the protests,
of course, yeah.
Police homicides of unarmed citizens. On that note, the protests after the Eric Garner killing and Michael Brown killing, they've been occurring also at the same weather time of the year, which shows, you know, it's one thing in California, well, here it is snow, so you can protest, but it makes special grit to go out when the weather is. But that's part of getting back to the media propaganda. I mean, media propaganda, that's part of the ruling class playbook. Is beat up on the left. No lie or lies are too outrageous, because even if you own the press, you know, you and the left doesn't have much.
And I also think about and have conversations with folks at these screenings about the left and how the left doesn't really have a glue that gels them together in the same way that the right does. Mm-hmm. You know, the right has some issues that are just, they're unbending together on those issues, whatever they are. You know, I mean, guns, you know, this is an issue that people are kind of unbending on. There's other issues. But the left, it's like there's so many issues, and it seems like the left ends up arguing over whose banner is going to be at front of the march and whether or not it's going to be about solar power or GMO labeling or, you know, the list goes on and on and on. But there aren't issues that, like, gel. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, you're
right. And
it's called intelligence. Because there are very many issues, and they are specific.
Yeah, they are specific, and there are so many issues. But people will put their issue, will say, no, my issue is actually more important, and I don't want to talk about your issue right now, and your issue can go to the back. I don't know what the solution is. I see that as a thing that keeps the left disintegrated. Do you think so, or do you think that's not true?
Are you asking me?
Mm-hmm.
No, I agree with you.
Yeah.
I'm just saying...
It's really not strategic. It's so disorganized. It's so disorganized.
But a movement, you know, a change.
Because there was no one to vote in, number one. And also, I mean, I think one of the things that did work is that we saw that when there wasn't top, you know, there wasn't information coming from the top down. I mean, it was really the membership was in front of the leadership, you know, the rank and file was in front of the leadership. And the grassroots were really, that was the beauty of it, the organic nature of it, that no one was trying to co-opt it until, you know, until long after.
Until the recall?
Yeah, and some people say that national unions had a piece of that also.
Yeah, because you had an interview with the AFL-CIO guy.
David Newby.
Yeah.
Yeah, I show this to union groups. You know, I show it to many different audiences, really a wide range of audiences. I mean, not so wide. I haven't shown it to strictly Walker supporters yet. But when I show it to union groups, I sometimes get, you know, I kind of wonder, are they going to be mad? Because there's a whisper of a critique in here of the unions. But David Newby, former head of the AFL-CIO, he and always the unions end up saying the same thing, which was, no, that's the issue, is that it's that the hierarchy ends up creating a system where it's not totally all about the membership, and it is disorganized in that sense that the membership doesn't actually get to be as effective as what they would, you know, should be.
Well, it's ironic. It comes from the leadership, the retired executive leadership.
Yeah, they said, yeah. I mean, David Newby said, exactly, you hit the nail on the head.
And yet, I just find that very, for the AFL-CIO to say that, because they've been on the wrong side of a lot of power struggles, especially in Central America, Central and South America, in their unholy alliance with the CIA and the Vatican in trying to unseat democratically elected leaders. And it's just, you know, I mean, this is the same thing,
yeah.
Except that there was really technically no bloodshed. They had to go out
right.
And start mowing people down or, I mean, they arrested the leaders, you know. And,
I showed it to a group in New York. It was a huge cross-section of... Federation of Labor Groups. So all kinds of different members, all kinds of different unions were represented. And it was just before the election, midterm. And so there were different, so all of the different union groups had their banners all over the room. And it was this very polite screening and very polite Q&A, and everything seemed fine. And I thought it was wrapping up. And then this lady who was kind of sitting on the edge of her seat the whole time, I was waiting for her to say something, but she never did. And then finally, just as I thought it was wrapping up, she said something, and she was like, I just got to say, I feel like I'm in the twilight zone right now, because I'm looking around at all of these banners, and I'm in this room with all of these union heads, And you all endorsed candidates that are totally anti-labor. And so, and we just watched this film that's supposed to be a critical analysis, and you boneheads are in here, part of the problem. And then it became a very animated conversation. It was great. It was great because she was talking specifically to the folks that brought me there. And so it ended up being like a therapy session, you know? It was a facilitated conversation. And one of the union heads said, well, we have to start somewhere, and this is a good place to start. Because one of the things that I think union groups are seeing is that their membership is going down and that people are not wanting to be engaged and that they're not doing anything that's particularly new or interesting. And so I think they're realizing, or at least they're telling me, they're realizing that they have to engage in new ways, and they have to use different strategies, and they have to not only just bring in new membership, because that seems like that's only fulfilling their dream for a larger membership, but to actually be doing new things. And so.
Well, you can see that even the cops and the firefighters, who are usually the most staunch brotherhood of all, you know, never mind, there are firefighters, but still, you know, that they only came on the task after they saw that people were, you know, likely going to be dragged away. So, in some ways, it just seems that everybody's waiting for the other shoe to drop. And
yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Police union in Milwaukee endorsed Walker.
Why?
Because I think they're operating out of a place of fear, and they're afraid of what they're going to get, what's going to happen to them if they don't.
You mean they?
For this last midterm election, when he was up for re-election, they endorsed Walker. The firefighters endorsed Burke.
Remember that both groups were penciled out of all those austerity measures. The cops and the firefighters were not going to be.
That was done on purpose.
Right, exactly. Just split.
Yeah.
Divide and conquer. Yeah.
Yeah.
But now, do they have collective
bargaining? No one does. It's a statewide thing. No one has collective bargaining. There's no collective. Oh, that's a good question.
They do.
That's a good question, right, because they were exempt from the public sector workers, yeah.
I'd like to comment on the elections were very close. Parker first won, it came down to a very spurious.
Yeah.
County executive who took her, I don't know what she was, ballot person. Anyway, she took a computer home, brought it back, 7 feet down, and both appeared out of nowhere.
Literally, Kathy Nicholas. Yeah. She'd worked for Walker before in the clerk's office in Milwaukee.
She literally found votes on her computer.
Very,
very cool. And the recall, we got more petitions, more signatures to recall him than the original vote, but a third of Wisconsin people just didn't like the process. Still probably did not like Walker at that point, but they didn't like the process. So fully a third of Wisconsinites right away said, no, I'm not voting for a recall because they just don't lay it up. I don't believe it. It's not a valid process. And you may have a point, you know.
And I think that was a genius move on Walker's campaign, is that they did this amazing job of delegitimizing the whole recall process.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I saw these glossy ads on TV when I was there and on the internet that, you know, it was a basketball player and a farmer and a teacher, and they said, you know, I don't believe in Walker's politics, but I really don't believe in the recall process. That's not the American way. It's not the way we do it here. At the end of these things, I was like, geez, I don't know if I believe in the recall process. Maybe it isn't the way to go, but not really. But it was masterful. I mean, so many people that voted for Walker went on to vote for Obama.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah, it's.
Who never found his shoes.
Didn't even. I mean, he was so off of the radar, you know. And Michelle Obama didn't even come. I mean, it was.
And they're practically neighbors. They live in
Chicago.
Hyde Park, Chicago. Yeah.
Yeah.
What is that? A 90-mile drive or 150-mile drive?
So close.
Yeah.
So.
It was the recall here. Resulted in Schwarzenegger.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, right.
The most incompetent.
Daryl Steinberg would not agree with you. And there is a liberal, bleeding heart guy. You know, he part of the Gang of Five. Our own politics here really mirrored some of that, too.
But I mean, but Davis was outseated.
Yeah.
Walker won. I mean, this was also the first election that we had in this country post the Citizens United ruling. So that's also kind of interesting. I think we could maybe expect other elections to look similar.
Could you talk about WORTFM and the connections that you engendered, and also kind of describe what their brand of community radio?
Yeah. I would be so happy to talk about WORT Radio because I love them and because community media is something that I deeply believe in. And it's 100% why I do the work that I do. And because I believe that while we don't have a free press, we can't possibly be living in a democracy. And so I believe it's very important that we maintain independent rights to tell stories that are reflective of our communities rather than commercial interests. So WORT is a really a great model of a community radio station in Madison, Wisconsin. They've been around since December 1st, 1975. And they have a very wide reach with their tower. And I, when I was sent there from the media outlet in Minnesota, they said, hey, you want to go and say hello to the people at WORT Radio. And as a person who's been working in community media for many years, it's just what you do. You know, when you are a journalist connected to community media, you can find community and, you know, and kind of extended family in other community media outlets. And so it was just a natural relationship. I went there, I said hi, and filmed Jesse Jackson, and then went to the WORT station where I set up they gave me a desk. I sat there and, I sat there and I would edit video all night long and drink coffee all night long. And it was incredible. And so, their radio station is, they have a lot of news. They have a lot of community producers. They have fun drives all the time, a lot. And they have a wide range of programming, and
what kind of community radio experiences did you have back in Vermont that led you to believe that this would be fruitful?
Well, in 2001, I became involved with the indie media movement in response to the anti-globalization movements that were happening on the West Coast. Remember these things that were happening in Seattle? And so I was at that time living in Idaho, and so I was involved with anti WTO protests and all of these things. And so I became involved with indie media and helped to make a public access TV show at the time with a couple of other indie media makers. And then I moved to Vermont in 2004 and promptly started doing field production for our government television station. It's like a community C-SPAN, where you just film these kind of long, boring meetings, and you film press conferences, and we also had a live call-in talk show once a week, and I directed that, and was making just video, short-form videos for the web and spinning it out to various media outlets. And so that's my experience with community media.
And you found it to be positive? Or?
Yeah, it's totally positive. I mean, it's my feeling that that we shouldn't expect that Fox News is going to stop what they're doing, or that any of these corporate media outlets, they're not going to stop what they do because they're powered. They're powered by this playbook that you're talking about, and it's just part of the machine. It's just part of the machine. And so I believe that we need to, not even as a defense to that, is just that we need to create our own media. And so when I say community media, I mean media that's not funded by any outside interest.
You remember the Air America? Or
yeah.
Their whole system of radio stations.
Al Franken, yeah.
Yeah, Al Franken, the whole thing.
They ran out of money.
Yeah,
which is the issue. You know, it's a major issue, Ellen.
I was wondering if
No, now there is a branch of the Women's International Institute of Freedom active in Madison. Were they involved?
Yeah, they were so involved. I'm connected with Women's International League for Peace and Freedom in Vermont. And so as a result of my relationship with the group in Vermont, I have a natural connection with the gals in Wisconsin. And so, yeah, they were there. They were there the whole time. And they were in a cut of the movie, and I didn't make it. But they were totally involved. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Are you involved with the Wilt Pier?
Here, yeah.
Yeah. Neat.
And I know Robin Morgan.
Oh, you do? Neat. Yeah.
Which leads me to a question about what was your editing strategy? You shot all this, this video and sound. How much was it? How did you envision what you were doing here?
So the
three-hour-long thing, a series of 24.
So it was. So I shot between 125 and 130 hours of footage, which is pretty manageable. That's not totally unruly.
And considering 7 months, that's not a lot either, right?
I mean, it's all relative. It's really relative.
About 3 hours.
So I had 125 to 130 hours of footage, and my process was. Practically speaking, it was a three-act structure. So the film is built in three acts. I worked with a story consultant, this very talented woman, Fernanda Rossi, who is a story consultant for documentary filmmakers, and she helped me to tease out the storyline and how to build the narrative arc. And I'm gifted at telling stories from start to finish. I know how to do that. I know how to cover an event from the beginning to the end. I can do that. But creating a narrative arc, it was something that was new to me. And so I needed help with that. And so she was very helpful. And the movie at first was 2 hours, and then it was an hour and a half. And then I showed it to, I had advisors, and I had screening groups that I would show it to on a semi-regular basis. And the hour and a half film was just really boring. It was just so boring. The two-hour film, almost made you mad. It was so boring. It was just like, it did not need to be that long. And some of those screenings were a little bit terrifying because you could feel tension, and then people were a little aggressive in the questioning and the suggestions. And then so at an hour and a half, it still seemed precious, but it was still boring. And then an hour, I ultimately made the decision to make it just under 60 minutes. I feel that an hour I don't think it needed to be longer. And I mean, some people in Wisconsin really believe that there were lots of the story that are left out, and that the recall process needed to be documented, and the Democratic Party needed a lot more attention than what they got. But I felt that an hour was plenty of time, and then I also wanted there to be energy left for a conversation afterwards. And I feel like a two-hour movie doesn't always leave that. So that was my process with that. So it went through many, many, many cuts. And I hired a couple of people along the way to help, with the shooting and the editing and other pieces of it. But this is the second film that I've made. I made a short, a 26-minute documentary in 2010, and that process helped to give me a little bit of experience.
The clip where the fake Koch brother talks to Parker.
Yeah.
You cut it off before you got to the Parker, and he was talking about bringing in goons.
Yep.
Is that you did it on purpose?
I did, only because it was kind of. There were a lot of things that Walker said that were outrageous, and in that phone call. But this it seemed like the point was that Walker was willing to take a phone call from someone who he thought was a Koch brother, but he wouldn't even talk to his constituents or to other lawmakers. And so that was kind of the main point. The main point wasn't what he was saying; it was that he would just even give audience to this guy. And the other pieces of of information that Walker shared didn't actually move the story forward. And so I would always come back to that. Does this point move the story forward, or does it not?
I would hope that if we've done it, Walker can run for president, but hopefully it'll come out as a national venue.
Well,
we said, I thought about bringing in goons and making it a violent protest.
Making it look like a violent protest. Yeah, I mean, that whole video, that whole audio is on, it's on, you know, it's on YouTube. I mean, there's, it's totally available, so. And Ian Murphy, he lives in Buffalo, New York. You know, he's, you know, I interviewed him right after. You know, which I think is just amazing because he's not this particularly bright-looking person. He is a very smart person.
Or suave, maybe.
Yes, yeah. He's not suave, and he doesn't care. He's not trying to be. It's totally fine. But it's just, that makes it even more beautiful that this guy pulled it over on Walker.
Well, Walker looks like he has hair implants. You know, I mean, that's the kind of guy Walker looks like. You know, I mean, he's got that coat. I mean, he's about appearances. And so I don't see that he wouldn't be afraid to say something like that to Coke.
No.
But at the same time, would he stand up and would he do it? You know, that'd be the other question.
There's this video.
Just the fact that he considered it.
Well, no, I agree. But does he have the cojones to do it? You know, I mean,
there's this video that's on the web, and this filmmaker in Wisconsin named Brad Lichtenstein shot it. He was filming Walker for another film called Janesville. You might have interest in seeing it. And the largest funder to Walker's campaign is this woman. She's the wealthiest woman in Wisconsin. Her name is Diane Hendricks. And it's unbelievable. I mean, maybe you even saw it. It's the divide and conquer shot where Diane Hendricks, and it's very personal. It's only the two of them and Brad with the camera. And Diane says to Walker, what are we going to do about these unions? How are we gonna deal with this union thing? And Walker says, divide and conquer. And that circulated right before the recall. And it seemed like a slam dunk. It was great timing, you know? But it didn't make a difference. And you know, I like the point that Kucinich makes actually. It's one of my favorite things, which is that it's not really about Walker. It's not really about the individual, because once Walker gets out of there, it's just someone else. It's the system, you know? I mean, Walker just happens to be he's just this puppet, you know? And I wonder if he'll beat Ryan, because Paul Ryan certainly wants to be doing this, but I guess time will tell. Running for president, I mean. Well, thank you all very much.
Actually, I have a question. What's next?
What's next for me?
Yeah.
What's next for me is hopefully a job where I get to work with many other people. So I'm right now working on projects with larger groups of people, because this was a lot of alone time, and I definitely would check that box, works well with others. And so I've been working independently and for myself for many years, and so now I am working on projects with other groups of people, media related. And I'll have other films in the future, but not in the same way that I made this.
Yeah, I noticed that the first credit to you is edited, what is it, shot, edited, and
direct produced film, yeah.
Right, yeah, that's, yeah.
I want to thank you for sending me my copy as I was a bonus cleaner.
Oh, all right. Thank you very much for your support. Absolutely, thank you. Great. All right, well, so we have DVDs for sale, and thank you all very much for coming.